3, 2, 1. Let's start. Welcome to the show, and thank you for supporting the EOA podcast, Mac. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I just want to dive right into it.
Sure.
Especially where you spend most of your time these days, which is as Vistage chair, right? Where you spend a lot of time coaching, mentoring a group of executives, CEOs, founders, entrepreneurs. But maybe for the audience who doesn't know, maybe you could help start off by telling us what exactly is Vistage and what exactly is your role?
Okay. Let me just start by asking you guys some questions. First of all, you notice that every top athlete in the world has a coach, no matter who you are, whether you are, you know, a great tennis player or a bowler or anybody, okay, or a basketball player. Even concert pianist has a coach.
True.
Why? Because you need someone, a pair of eyes, a pair of ears, outside your body to give you feedback, to tell you exactly what you are doing, right or wrong. So this is what a coach is. Okay? We, with experience, pick up your little flaws or areas that you can improve and work on it. That's what coaching is all about. Okay? Now, mentoring. Mentoring is what we run through life with a bit of experience and we add in our 2 cents worth. Okay, coming back to Vistage that you asked. Vistage is a coaching platform working together with your peers and the people that of different verticals, meaning different kinds of business. They are all CEOs. They are all business owners. They have got a different set of minds so that they can work on your problem outside the box. That's what it's all about. And you build trust. That's the first thing you do. With any coach, whether you are an athlete, professional, or anybody, you build trust. That's where you start.
Okay. So what exactly then is your role as chair?
As a chair, I facilitate 8 to 16 people. Some now I have got a lot more. And we talk to each other. How would I say it? I don't like the word counsel, but we talk. We talk to each other, and I will try to understand as much as I can, as fast as possible, and using my experience, right, to, how would I say, lead the session, this one. Sometimes I might not know all the answers. The person involved will lead the discussion.
Okay.
So it is a two-way coaching thing.
And you're talking about, so there's an element of one-on-ones, but there's also the group sessions too.
Yes.
Okay. And so you are more talking about on the one-on-one sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. And so you said 18 to 16, so that's maybe one group, but you do multiple groups, right?
Yes.
How many groups?
I have, well, officially two. I do sometimes take on a few smaller groups.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, as and when, because I know that I'll kill myself having too many.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's about 50 to 60 plus people that you're probably actively coaching at any given time?
About 40 plus.
Okay, that's quite a lot.
Yes.
It's very intensive. It's aside from your other professional work, it's almost a full-time job in itself, right?
It is, yeah.
Okay, so how does that kind of look operationally? I know you spend maybe half the month intensively on this. So what does a typical week or within a month look like to do this?
Well, let me just give you an idea. I coach more than 1,000 hours.
Wow.
Okay, think about it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the average. I'm thinking about the average work week.
Right? Yes, yes.
And that's very significant.
Yes. So a lot of people say, "Wow, you know, how do you manage that?" And the funny thing is that it's not a chore. It is quite a contrary. I actually look forward to it. Well, I hate to say this, but I have no accountability. Think about it.
Well, I don't know. You're accountable to the relationship. And otherwise, the relationship doesn't work out if there's no mutual value gained from it.
Correct.
So. Yeah. But I guess in an economic return sense, less than a consultant and even less than an owner, right?
So, yes.
So I kind of get what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, that brings me to my first main question, because I really want to narrow down on the coaching slash mentoring. Well, first off, do you say you do more coaching, more mentoring, and
both? Actually, it depends on what hat I need to wear.
Yeah. Okay.
As and when. Mm-hmm. That's kind of thing.
Okay. And then I think the most important foundational question is, what qualifies a person to be a coach? Like, how can I trust you, and how can I say that, you know,
okay,
what you're saying makes sense and is true?
I guess age is one thing.
Okay.
Right? If you don't have the age, basically at least 20 years of experience working, mm-hmm, in terms of ownership, entrepreneur, if you're never a CEO, it's very difficult to look at it.
It's kind of true. Like, say if you get a personal trainer, typically what's recommended is they can lift the same weight as you can. Otherwise, you don't have that feeling, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So that is one. And I guess very important quality, listen. Mm-hmm. Listening is very important, because the problem with CEOs is that we are, at that time, taught to give results, give answers, everything very quickly, because time is a factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this time around, we have to sit down and listen first, because we have to assess the situation. Mm-hmm. We have to understand.
Yeah.
So that is the most important part.
In terms of listening versus talking, how do you split that percentage-wise?
Oh, 4-1.
4-1.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four times more listening.
Okay, so then it's most of the times these sessions would be CEOs probably doing majority of the talking, and you're just absorbing, and then...
Correct.
When do you speak up then?
Well, when there is a session on, chances are they will be talking to you, reflecting their problem. Mm-hmm. And we just ask questions, prodding them along.
Yeah.
Okay? So there will be time that I says, I hear you. I understand that this is the direction that you're going. But always keeping in mind, very clear, is that what is the objective?
Okay.
Okay? So that will give you the ultimate direction. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, I would say 80-90% of the time, when we question that clearly, the CEO actually knows the route.
Yeah.
Knows where they are going. Yeah. Except when they're sitting alone, then there's nobody to talk to, and they're going around in circles.
Yeah, they have tunnel vision.
Yes.
So then, yeah, you keep iterating on you know, the same context, but it doesn't go anywhere because you need more context typically, which helps by talking and having other people listen.
Correct.
And so, and essentially, you're, you know, heading towards my other questions, which is the framework for coaching. What kind of system do you follow, or what kind of framework do you apply?
Okay. There are a few things that I have to have basic. For example, the way you think, the mindset. You'd be surprised, a lot of CEOs don't actually know what the concept of a business is.
Can you clarify?
Okay. Do you agree with me that business is an infinite game?
That's a very interesting that you bring that up, because I think later in this discussion, I actually wanted to ask about your career, and that's one of the things I want to bring up, is that I actually don't think business inherently is an infinite game. However, we do have outliers that are very enduring, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess the short answer is I don't think so in general, no.
Okay. So that is the kind of thinking that I need to set your mind to.
Okay.
Another thing is that I also want to know, do you have, what kind of mindset do you have?
Mm-hmm.
Because that will determine how far you're going to grow.
I see.
All right? If you have a closed mindset and you don't want to do it, there's nothing I can do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, you don't want to learn how to cycle, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I give you a story. My wife didn't want to learn how to cycle because she felt that she's too old.
Mm.
Okay? Just for the record, my wife is 52.
Okay?
She says that, look, I'm too far ahead
in
life to learn how to cycle on the, you know, cycle.
Mm.
But my two other kids, all could cycle, learning how to cycle, all could cycle.
Yeah.
And she's left out.
Mm.
So I just basically brought her along by saying that, you want to join us? Cycle around the park? Learn how to cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's to create the desire for her to learn. That's how she improves.
Okay.
Now, so we are all happily now cycling around.
Mm-hmm.
Is it so? It's just the right, how would I say, inducement.
Mm.
Basically, is to encourage the person. Like I said, if you don't want to do it, I can't do anything.
Okay. So foundationally, the beginning of the framework is assessing if a person is essentially coachable.
Yes.
And this, I mean, I was going to ask this later on, but since it's brought up now, are all people coachable or
no?
Not everyone.
No, no. Let me tell you, before I take on anybody, I normally have about an hour or two session with them.
Yeah.
Just to assess, because it's what I call a mutual selection.
Yeah.
Whether you like me or whether I like you.
True.
So that would be my starting point.
Okay. Okay, so you have a nice foundation. So let's say we get past the point, you know, there's mutual acceptance, good compatibility, which is very important. You assess the mindset. So then in terms of the next part of the framework, how do you think about developing the coaching relationship or what happens next?
Well, I ask a lot of questions about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I ask them, where do you want to go from here?
Yeah.
I start by asking, how did you get here?
Yeah.
The next thing is just, where do you want to go to?
Mm.
So the methodology of coming here and going there is two different things.
Yeah.
So that is where I start.
Okay. So establishing goals, essentially.
Right.
Do you take into account your own goals as well? I mean, actually, so when I look for a coach, then does there have to be compatibility on both sides or does it really matter? The executive being coached is it very selfish in the respect that they only... that matters the most, or?
Well, we always say that the client, okay?
Yeah.
The coachee has the most say.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. But where do I draw a line?
Yeah, correct.
I would draw a line with things that I'm not very familiar with.
Mm.
Okay. For example, if you ask me to talk about coaching a person in a music industry, I've got no clue.
Yeah.
The basics are the same.
Yeah, fundamentals of business, yes.
Yes, but I can't go far.
Yeah.
Okay.
True. The main expertise, essentially.
Yes.
Part of your framework, right? So you establish the foundation, you establish the goals. Your method or your style seems very Socratic in nature. Okay. Ask questions, right? But I think we know some people are not very receptive to questioning in that kind of manner. So it doesn't mean they're not coachable. So... how does that work out then when you have a client or a coachee who does not respond very well to coaching? Because it's a fine line. It's almost at a point where you'll say, no, they're not coachable. But maybe it's not necessarily the case. So I'm sure you have some clients like this. So.
Yes, we do. We do. Well, like I said, I've spoken to countless hundreds of people.
Yeah.
One of the first things that I ask them to be comfortable,
yeah. Mm.
Be vulnerable,
mm.
Tell me, because whatever is said between you and me is kept within the four walls.
Yeah.
Right? That would be a good start.
Mm-hmm.
So some people take longer.
Yeah.
There are times, many times, that I spoke to a person. After a while, they broke down and cry.
Mm.
Okay? Sometimes, I mean, on all my table, it's always a box of tissue. And trust me, it's not only women. Yeah. Guys do that too.
I'm sure, yeah.
You know? So it takes, how would I say, a little knack from me to peck on the little hole there and open it up.
So I'm very curious about the nuance there because how do you determine that they're not coachable versus I should poke a little bit, then value and it fruits later on, right? It's very blurry, right?
Yes, it is. Mm. I guess that comes down to experience.
Okay.
Yeah. I can give you an example. I spoke to a guy who is quite senior.
Yeah.
Probably about near retirement. Why I say that is that age do play a role.
Okay. Mm.
So he was winding up his position. He has a succession problem.
Mm.
I could identify all that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, he felt like... He just needed someone to talk to. He wasn't building a business.
Okay.
Okay. So actually, he was looking at the second chapter.
Yeah.
Looking for a second chapter.
Yeah.
You see? So at the end of the day, at the end of the session, I will just tell him what I feel and explain to him what he's looking. And I will tell him that, you know, you can work with me, but it's going to be a short while.
Because you only get him started on the next chapter of the journey.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, then he realized, then I said, okay, think about it before we even embark on the second part.
Mm.
So that's fine. At the end of the day, actually he took on professional coaching.
Okay.
Which is perfectly fine with me.
Yeah. So what does that mean, professional coaching versus like, okay, so he hired someone just for him only?
No, he became a coach.
He took on professional coach. So he, okay, maybe he realized that was his fulfillment.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Well, he showed him that, that was, you know, so. But yeah, I guess that's the nature of the business too,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I mean, and plus, ultimately, if you have more coaches that are good, it just benefits the ecosystem ultimately
too.
Yeah. So what was your conception of coaching before going into Vistage, and has that conception changed?
Yes. I think that my perspective of things slightly changed because in the past, I looked at coaching was everything is based on my experience.
Mm.
I've walked the journey. I will tell you what my journey looks like.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it. Shove it. That's what it is, okay. Right? That's my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So probably a little bit egoistical of all, you know?
Very natural for successful business owners, right? So
yeah. Listen to me. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
When I took it on, then I realized that after listening, you know, my perspective might not be correct.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's where the group facilitation comes.
Mm.
When I said that I will tell you very clearly that this is only my perspective. I need the rest of the people.
Yeah.
Think outside the box and give suggestions.
Mm.
Then we could explore further.
Yeah. Was there a specific moment that led to that realization?
What happened was that, I realized that when I joined Vistage 2005 or 2006, that long ago. And that's when I...
You joined as...
Member.
As a member, okay.
Okay, I joined as a member.
Yeah.
Then it opened my mind up and I could see that it leveraged on different perspective of things. Which I think that's what we want.
Yeah.
As a leader, you go in and say, I'm going route A, B, and C, but that could be D, E, and F.
Yeah.
So that's what we want. We want choices. Ultimately, we still make the decision anyway.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So that's the fundamental change that I realize that I'm not right all the time.
Mm. Here's an interesting thought then. Why... Do you think that's more common in companies to not be able to build that culture, to build that function within the company? Is that why they need things like Vistage? Or why aren't there more companies just doing that inherently if it's very beneficial?
It boils down to the person. Because the person actually, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
That's true. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So a lot of us, especially the Asian culture, we get our mentor or coach from our father or uncle or relative on top of us, they just beat down on you.
Mm.
Then when you open up and open yourself up to other perspective, then you realize.
Okay.
That's the interesting part.
That's the exposure. So it begs, it's like almost a chicken and egg problem though. So if you're this type of owner or CEO, what has led them to something like Vistage? Like how could they even be open to it if they're not even from that culture to begin with?
Exactly. Okay, good point. I've met a lot of young CEOs recently, the second gen.
Yeah, right? The ones inheriting.
Yes, okay. Yes. Amazing. Because they will come and sit down with me, have a cup of coffee, and they will tell me their life story. And one thing good about them is that they're very vulnerable about it.
Mm.
Especially when I can relate.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell them this is what's happening. Mm. They say, oh my God, this is true.
Yeah.
And after talking about 2 hours... I could actually predict what's going on.
Mm.
I'm not God. I don't pretend that I know all.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you talk to one, two, three, the 50th one.
It's a pattern for sure.
The pattern will show.
Yeah.
So I asked them very point blank, how do you know about me?
Mm.
Okay. Oh, my friend recommended.
Mm.
So in my line of work, I don't go out and scout now.
Yeah.
I don't have to go marketing. It's just by word of mouth. All I can't handle. Yeah, yeah, I can't handle it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My groups are full. I can't take any more because, you know, I've got 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Of course.
No more, no less. I couldn't squeeze anybody in. But I do still receive a lot of calls asking me to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I will look at some other coaches and say to them, talk to them.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. So by word of mouth, and you'd be surprised, the second gen people are generally very similar pattern.
When you say, so what is this age group? We're talking 30s, mid-30s, millennials essentially then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And yeah, I guess Gen Z would be too young at this point to be inheriting.
Not yet.
And would you contrast then say Gen X or even older generation towards coaching? Is that even harder for them to approach? Or do they get word of mouth too in that generation group?
That generation tend to be a little bit reserved.
Okay.
I know it all.
Mm.
It's those who want to go beyond the level, they will explore.
Yeah.
Okay. But once they explore and they talk, they realize. So I have a lot of members that are much older, in their 50s.
Yeah.
And we are in a different level of playing field.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
We talk a lot of things very deep, personalized, different from the 30 plus 40. Yeah. Very different. And generally, I think that their wants are very different.
Mm.
And their needs are very clear.
Different stages of development, I guess.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So then it's being able to identify those different goals within the stages and then matching patterns and then establishing the trust relationship to kind of make this kind of work.
Right? Yeah.
So what are some of more of the unexpected things you've learned from full-time coaching, basically?
Oh, besides coaching, I do life coaching and I do personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it very candidly.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they do pour their heart out, good and bad. relationships, all those areas, I do talk about it. And I'm very clear because I am acting as a third party standing outside, looking at the person.
Not judging.
No judgment at all.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. So I guess So if you get like a mix of personal and professional, is there any common elements of things that surprise you or is it different every time?
Let me talk to you. Different age group have different types of regrets.
Mm.
Make sense?
Yeah.
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 So each regret, if you look at the regret and confront them, then you can look forward.
Mm.
So that's what I help them to do.
Yeah, it's a pretty good tool to develop too if you are trying to develop yourself, regret minimization as a framework to make decision making, right?
Yes. So
and I think a lot of people who have that kind of stress in their life probably never maybe thought about it deeply to do that. And I guess it's also hard. So it's why you need the help of someone else to maybe kind of get you there.
All right. Right? Yeah. All right.
Okay. And then in terms of the clients who have very specific goals, how do you go about tracking performance then?
Ah, straightforward. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the lag indicator, which is financials.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Of the business.
Yes.
But are they always financially like anchored, the goals?
Well, if you talk about business,
that
would be the ultimate thing, right?
Yes, true.
Yeah. Of course, besides that, we do talk about other things because the ultimate... Financials are not a great indicator, right? I mean, it's lagging all the time. Yeah. By the time you know that you're doing badly, then you say you're screwed up.
Yeah.
So those are the things. And I will run through step by step what are they doing now as to what I think they should be doing. Sometimes, a lot of times, they know. They just need somebody to push them, nudge them along. Okay. So one of the things that I learned over time is how hard should I push sometimes?
Yeah.
How hard should I nudge? Okay. Mm-hmm. There is no guarantee that I know that it will work.
Mm.
If you come to me and tell me that my business is going down the tubes, chances are I will say to you, I can't help you.
Yeah.
Because it's already gone downhill.
Mm.
So assuming that you're going on plateau and you tell me that, you know, 3 years, 5 years from now, I want to find an inflection and scale up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're going downhill, I will look at it and tell you, these are the things that you have to start looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very simple.
Of course.
Yeah. It's very simple.
Yeah.
But the excitement is actually when you're doing scaling. Mm. Scaling up, scaling down, breaking into new business.
Yeah.
Or sometimes when you're so asphyxiated in a single revenue source, I would tell you that, no, look, start looking at something else. Some people are just, you know, they think they are great.
Yeah.
The company is doing well.
Mm.
I said, the biggest problem that you have is that you think you're good. That is your biggest problem.
Yeah.
So then they start to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need a third party outside to look at it.
Okay. So then, yeah, so then that's measuring by financial performance. Also, I guess, by feeling, right?
Yes.
If they're happy with the relationship.
Yeah.
Then what about the worst experience you had coaching? Is there anything really bad that you've come across?
Touch wood. No. I mean, I have an interesting experience once where it's to do with personal relationship and very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
I actually said to the person, stop.
Yeah.
You know, if it is affecting the professional side of you, sort it out.
Mm.
You know, I really can't help.
Yeah.
You know, it's between two other parties, not me.
Yeah.
You know, stop, sort it out.
Okay.
And I try to focus them on that area.
Mm.
Okay. That's what it means.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. So if a business is not doing well, even though you point out what they should be doing, are you saying that the outcome most likely will still be the same where it doesn't improve or that it's harder? What are you saying?
The outcome is not going to change. For example, I have one particular member. Because they are financially very sound, okay, and they are not moving, happy with what it is, I've given an ultimatum. If you continue to be like this, you don't need me.
Mm.
I don't see a role that I will play. And I don't want to keep you there just for the sake of keeping there. I could serve somebody else.
Yeah, someone get more value out of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about money.
Yeah.
It's just that if don't keep my time.
Do you think that's maybe an end goal for most of your clients then, where they've been able to identify what is enough? Because everyone sort of, otherwise you'll never be happy if you don't reach this kind of point, or at least maybe it's an inflection to a new chapter, like for some of your clients, right? So is that where all these relationships are heading then?
I have got many clients that, you know, we come in and we talk about the ideas, the objectives, the end goal. To reach your end goal, we have to do this.
Yeah.
And some of them have done it very well. But when I have one particular one that's done so well that I told him, you're doing better outside this country.
Mm.
Which he did.
Yeah.
He started exploring and he comes to, hey, you know what? You're right. I'm going to set up office here. I'm set up office here.
Mm.
Good for you. I encouraged it. At the end of the day, I said to him, I says, you know, you'll be spending a lot of time flying in and out.
Yeah.
You won't have time for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to think of not only him, but also as the group. Imagine if you are one of the group members and you don't show up.
Mm.
You're not contributing. It's not what you can take. It's what you can contribute to.
Yeah, it has to go both ways.
Yeah. So it has to go both ways. And I told them that if we function as a group, everybody must pull their weight, contribute.
Yeah.
That's what I'm telling everybody.
I see.
So some of them have to go.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one possible natural end. And how, so what about others? Like, do you help define what that enough looks like?
I do. Mm-hmm. But human beings are as such that enough is never enough.
Mm.
I have sat with one and I asked him, I says, what is enough for you? Tell me what enough looks like.
Yeah.
Okay. They drew a fuzzy picture, put it all together. 2 years down the road, that fuzzy picture got bigger.
Mm. More fuzzy or more clear?
Bigger, fuzzier picture.
Bigger, fuzzier picture. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I says, you know, realistically, you're now at this age. I'm not saying he's a professional. I said that, okay. You have to look at the sunset part.
Mm.
That means that you got to plan for you and your wife. Then he looked at me and says, what do you mean? I says, look, with all the money in the world, what are you going to do?
Mm.
Couldn't answer. You're not going to carry on like this, right?
Yeah.
To 65, 70?
Yeah.
So he looked at me and says, retire.
Mm-hmm. That must be really hard though.
It, well, when he left me, he was retiring.
Mm.
It took him another 3 years to retire.
Quite normal though, right?
Quite normal. Yeah. So we kept in touch.
Mm-hmm.
We do talk on the phone every now and then, how things.
Yeah.
And then he said to me, hey, I got this issue. What do you think? How do you do? I says, you got two ways. You talk to me or you come back to the group. Just present as a guest.
Mm.
Talk about it because everybody knows you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I can find a third party to help you to solve it up.
Yeah.
Pay that person.
Mm.
And I don't want to be, you know, don't pay me.
Yeah.
Because it's a conflict of interest, right?
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it would make more sense for this type of enough issue, maybe for the older generation.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
I think a younger person, yes, they're always hungry. So yes. There's always something to optimize. Right?
Correct.
Okay. If you were to distill maybe, I mean, you could take your time to think about it. What is probably the most important thing you've gotten, like learned from coaching executives?
Enjoy life.
Mm.
Because, you know, I'm 62. And it took a massive wake-up call
mm-hmm.
before I took a step back.
So you're always just working nonstop?
Yes. Yes. Mm. So after my heart attack and did a bypass,
mm-hmm.
money is not everything,
mm-hmm.
right? So I realized that I think I need to spend more time with my family.
Mm-hmm.
That's hence coaching him around.
Mm-hmm. I see. So how do you balance that with a young person who doesn't have the money? Because it's easy to say when you don't have, it's very existential when you don't have it, or when your money's tied up in equity and not actually liquid.
Mm.
So how do you balance saying that to a young person, or even like say mid-30s to 40s, while it is true, they probably may have regrets for not mm-hmm. spending enough time with the things that they care about, whether it be family or something else.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they also don't have that luxury of having that cash pile, right?
Yes, yes. So I think that you have to work towards a goal.
Mm.
So we set up little milestones
yeah.
that they have to try to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And reaching there, sort of tick off a check off a box
yeah.
one at a time.
Mm.
No promises. That is, you know, you check off 10 boxes, you'll be happy. No such thing.
Yeah.
Right? After 10, there'll be 3 more, 5 mm. more, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then across all your age groups, is there something that comes up as a recurring problem across all clients? Like what's the most common problem from coaching that you see?
Okay. I think generally I feel that a lot of people don't have enough ideas.
Mm.
Don't have enough. You think that this is the best thing
yeah.
since sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. So when I start pointing out, or when the group start pointing out, or when we start exchanging ideas and explore, then we realize that, oh shit, there's a lot more.
Mm.
You know? So that is generally business entrepreneur's problem, blind spot.
Mm. And how do you combat them? Like how do you get more diversity in your life or more exposure to expand your mindset?
Meeting people. Working with a group of people that you trust explicitly
mm.
And you know that when they say a spade is a spade, there is no agenda.
Yeah, it's, and I guess that's a big problem with CEOs is that within their own group, because they're in their position of power, they don't want to listen, even though it might be the same advice that a group outside would give, right?
Yeah. So yes.
It's very tricky. So I guess it's a very necessary function.
Correct.
So let's make it more relevant then. So with all, you know, your clients, what are they most worried about today, 2023, in the next few years? Or like maybe what are their, some of their greatest challenges that they're facing?
Today?
Yeah.
I think that everybody is worried about recession. We are very lucky in this part of the world.
Yeah.
I think we could escape it.
Right? Why is that?
I guess it's the position where we are. I mean, as in Malaysia, as our country. Okay. We are at the, well, how would I say it? At the right place at the right time. We are not strongly biased to Ukraine, China, Russia, or US.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So we are playing the right political game.
Yeah.
Okay. Therefore, our politicians got to get their act together.
Yeah, it's very interesting with the current news with the Prime Minister talking about how the U.S. the dollar is not necessarily needed to be the reserve. Right?
Yes.
It seems that there's some flavor changing, though.
And, yeah.
Which I guess points to maybe your executives' uncertainty concerns.
Yes.
Where how do I invest in the future if you don't know where that's heading, you know, in the context of possible recession, geopolitical lines also, at least in my world too, in terms of startups and investing in VCs, that's a big one too. Mm-hmm. Where do you structure your company if you're starting up?
Correct.
Like, who do you sell to? If you sell to, what's the inherent risk of those customers?
Correct.
So it's a very big problem these days. So let's move on then to more relevant stuff. Aside from Vistage, you know, where do you spend most of your time professionally then? What's your critical path?
Building memories with my family.
Okay.
That's the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blessed with three kids. Okay. Mm-hmm. The eldest will probably get married, hopefully end of the year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. With all goes well. And I got two very young ones, 11 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
And they are growing up pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I love them to bits.
Yeah.
And strange thing is that I have adult conversation with my son. Very adult conversation.
How old is he?
11.
You know, kids, they are more precocious than we realize. You know?
Yes, yeah. I know. Yeah. I kept looking at my relationship with my dad and him and me.
Mm.
And I ask him things like, does your friend talk to their father like what we do?
Mm.
And he says, no, dad. He says, why? Then he would rant on a lot of things. And I was trying to figure out what it means, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought that that's very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is wonderful. My eldest is establishing herself slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy with what she has done so far.
Yeah.
I guess that's, you know, what I want.
Okay. So does that mean you're more or less retired or...?
Tell people that I'm retired, but I've got projects running.
Yeah, exactly. Because I believe, at least on LinkedIn, it still says you're the CEO of Macaque Group.
Yeah.
So that's an official position, but those are just ongoing projects then.
Yes. I've got a joint venture with the 52-story building coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm still looking at development in Johor.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I tried to play it at the back of my mind now.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that, you know, when it comes, it comes.
Yeah.
Doesn't need me to be around.
Yeah.
I've got professional people.
So you professionalize the business.
Yes. I want to.
Yeah. Working on it.
Working on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So interesting. So does that mean for your current endeavors, is it more wealth generation focused or more wealth preservation focused at this point?
Both ways. Yeah. So when a good deal comes along, of course, I will strike.
Okay.
If not, then I can sit down and shake legs and
So you can bide your time. It's like typically a good focused value investor. They just wait for the right swing.
Yep.
If you miss a few, it's fine, but you just gotta make sure you get it. When you hit it, right?
Yeah.
What would you say your greatest domain expertise is these days? Would it be property development?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then let's pick some of your brain on the current state of property development then. What does the industry look like today, and how does that shape out in the coming years?
Well, a lot of people saying that, property is something that won't go far wrong, okay?
Okay.
It's funny is that, you know, if you build three houses, you are a developer. So that is something that I got ruled out because I've built a few thousand houses.
Okay.
Okay. In today's market, you have to be very careful. Property is not something that you buy a piece of land and develop. You buy the piece of land and you gestate. You need to gestate, okay? Because the value,
yeah,
the cost.
Yeah.
You buy a piece of land that's $10 today, if you build, it's too expensive. Mm-hmm. So you wait for 5 years, 10 years. Then $10 is very cheap because by now the escalation cost would have gone up to, I don't know, $50.
Yeah.
So it becomes cheap.
Mm-hmm.
See? So that's what developers are.
Yeah.
And the worst thing I always tell, I've got a lot of developer CEOs who have joined me.
Yeah.
I tell them, that, look, you know, the fastest way is to go down under is your next project.
Yeah, inherently by the nature of the business.
Yes.
It's very risky.
Yeah. It's very risky. And a lot of people will say, oh, you make a lot of money. You should look at the risk too.
Yeah, honestly, relative to the risk, relative to the margins, I find it's, at least from a world where it's not very asset heavy, mm-hmm. it's quite very risky to me at least.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I've talked to also various different developers too, and right, you have a few camps where if you're like these big listed companies, you can never stop building, which is also very scary during downturns.
Yeah.
Because you never have cash, and then your cost of capital goes up. It's hard to finance everything and have cash flow. And then you have the other developers who can do many projects, but they almost have like a shell company, right? It's just more like the holding company, but each project is a company.
Yes.
And they offload risk that way.
Yes. Right?
So that if one goes under, the whole thing doesn't go under.
That's right. It doesn't domino away.
Yeah. But it leads for this very weird space where, you know, you have cookie cutter, keep building, and then this other one where they just never take risks either, right? So it's kind of interesting. So for your developments, where have you sat in between the spectrum?
Well, I have not been, because of the current market situation, I have not been acquiring any properties at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Obvious. Pandemic, now no, don't buy land.
You're talking bare land or also buildings or?
Whichever, whatever. Yeah, okay. That comes, whatever opportunity that comes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I'm building on lands that was owned by my father.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the difference in terms of cost structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my cost structure is, I would say, minimal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of just taking off.
Yeah. I found that very interesting. I talked to a lot of family businesses who've been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, a lot of the businesses that they built over the past few decades, many of them are gone. But what, back then at least, you've had, when you build a business, you had to acquire the land too, at least.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And what they found out was that it was actually more valuable if they never did the business and they just held the land.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this seems to be a feature, at least within, probably it's very common in every market.
Very common.
Yeah, very common.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't lead to efficiencies, right? Or innovation.
Mm.
So is there any way that can be addressed, you think?
Peculiar to each individual business, right? You have to look at, that's why I always advocate revenue diversification.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cannot depend solely 100% on property development.
Yeah.
So I do advocate things like, look at something else.
Yeah.
I've got a client that's 100% on one particular product.
Mm.
Okay. And I said to him, generating enough cash, sitting there looking pretty, looking to other regions to go.
For the same model.
Same model.
Same product. Same,
yeah. It's just cookie cutter thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I said to him, can we do something else?
Mm-hmm.
Then he says, what? You know, go and fry char kway teow or something like that.
Or, something cash that brings in cash in, even if it's not the same business as big, right?
Yes.
At least it's still some diversification.
Correct.
Yeah.
Because that automatically reduce your risk.
Mm.
That's what I'm saying.
And I guess you've seen those cycles.
Yes.
You must have seen many families wiped out by being too concentrated on the next cycle and didn't diversify the revenue.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
And so do you have a specific investment thesis you focus on in property development, or how do you go thinking about generating business in this industry?
Well, like all leading edge technology, we have to look at what's the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you'd be surprised. I mean, in the old days, you look at houses, individual houses, terrace houses.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes tall buildings,
mm-hmm.
many of those. Now
townhouses.
Yeah, yeah. All this, and then become gated environment,
mm-hmm.
right? And then suddenly everybody start backing off. The senior people, the senior living.
Mm.
Yeah, you have to build communities.
Mm.
You have to start doing all that.
Yeah.
So those are the, I would say, the evolvement of property development,
mm-hmm.
going from the standalone. And now going into community building.
Is this because Malaysia is approaching the bottom of a high-income country? So like this is kind of well-known? Because say if you looked at very developed countries, it's probably a very different pattern or different thesis,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
So is that we have the benefit of we kind of see this coming and know how to act? Or how are you thinking about the problem from a first principles perspective?
No. Let me look at it this way. Because I travel quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend a lot of time in the US.
Mm-hmm.
You look at things.
Yeah.
And they say, wow, that's a good idea.
Mm.
What can I do at home?
Yeah.
That's what we do. Okay.
Very common, yeah.
Very common. So I guess that's like what you said, the evolvement, depending on each individual person, what kind of exposure they have. Mm. Because if I've not been traveling or I don't see the world, no matter how you sell the idea to me, it won't work because I'll be too conservative. My mindset is closed.
But there's also the fundamental macro constraints. Like the reason why we may not have higher quality developments because people just can't, they just won't buy it at a higher price. So sure. Naturally you're stuck with a certain quality,
yep.
or ties to the constraints of labor market.
True.
Certain skilled mm-hmm. workers, you just won't get the same quality of a developed nation.
Yeah.
So, you know, tied to bringing in new things plus constraints, I guess, kind of you end up where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so how do you tease out cutting edge then? Because that's what you said for your thesis.
Yes.
Like what's new and what's innovating and how does that?
Education.
Mm.
Educating your buyers.
Mm.
Telling them exactly what happened. I'll give you an example that what I've done once. One property project that I had, erosion. River erosion, water erosion,
mm-hmm.
very close to the project.
Yeah.
Tons of earth washed away.
Yeah.
Our roads, our thing was standing still.
Mm.
So a lot of people were surprised.
Yeah.
So I said that, you know, learning from the past, this is what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it will never, ever come up as an issue
yeah.
because it didn't happen. But once it happened, then you realize. Mm-hmm. Then you know what kind of quality that you have put in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen many.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the layman wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a problem, right?
Yes.
So how much is too much education where you know you're not going to move the market versus like you pair it to the right amount of risk to how much you educate, right?
Yeah.
So what is that balance? Like what do you educate in order to push the innovation forward?
I guess objective.
Yeah.
Ultimately, what is it?
Yeah.
Another one, which I learned from my dad, my late father, he famously put buildings up to about 5-6 stories because mm-hmm. at that moment of time, that's all the requirement. Any more doesn't make sense.
Mm. There's no market.
There's no market for
it. Yeah, back then.
So what he did was that he did piling and enough for another 3 or 4 stories.
Hmm. Interesting.
Never thought about it. I didn't know. He would tell me, the foundation here can take another 2 or 3 floors.
Hmm.
You know, when the time is right, put up the 3 floors.
Hmm. Interesting.
You see? He has already invested in the future.
How did he come up with that, though? Because it seems obvious in hindsight.
Yeah,
I know. We know the blueprint we've seen, but like back then it can't be that obvious. And also the extra cost is not probably worth it for a return.
Exactly. So like I said, you know, what is interesting is that what possessed him to think that way?
Yeah.
So unfortunately, he's not around for me to ask. So I guess you learn from that.
Yeah.
So all I did was, all I learned from him was prepare. Actually, you know, you never know what you never know.
Probably a good framework would be to examine unit economics and you take some percentage of risk that you could probably invest into it that it's just not going to kill your whole business model.
Right.
But
right.
at least it allows a room for future expansion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is it, you know, he's looking at, he did it when he was like probably in his 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
It only realized when he was like his 70s, you know?
So a lot of compounding experience.
Exactly.
You have to go through a lot probably to get
exactly,
there.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So that's something.
Yeah. So how about this other angle in terms of innovation? Do you do any angel investing in the property development space?
No.
No.
Why? I always believed that I could do better. no. In today's context, they take a lot of risk. I look at the risk, I can't palate. I said, I don't know.
Can you give me an example?
Okay. Very ambitious projects, meaning that their design is for this density.
Okay.
Okay. And they will tell you that I could push it up to this level.
In terms of cost per square foot or?
No, in terms of production. Okay.
Quality.
Whatever. Okay. Okay. So instead of building, let's say, 100 units of condo, they say I could do 120.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is the cost that you're going to incur.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a market for that balance 20? Do you compromise on design?
Yeah.
Those are the little things that I will ask. Definitely. Because when you put another 20 more units, your parking space is going to be, the requirement for parking changes.
Mm.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't worry. By the time we reach there, the market is there.
Yeah.
So, objective. So, do you want to quickly turn over, make your money and move on?
Mm.
Or do you have the firepower to say, I'll wait?
I would bet that the majority of players don't have firepower to wait.
Correct.
That's the nature of the market, right?
Correct, correct. Yeah. So a lot of them get, I mean, you look at their cash flows and you look and it says, you might not make this corner.
Mm.
So it's very scary.
Yeah.
The problem with me is that probably I know a little bit too much.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So
that's the hard part of the age is you get biased and jaded, but then how do you pair that to like what your father did?
Mm.
Right? There's this weird space where it's going to work, but it doesn't seem like it's going to work.
Yeah.
Like, for example, all those guys you're afraid of, how would you determine which one of those would work though?
Yes. 20 years from now, I might not be around, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they might be making tons of money, but like I said, I don't really know.
From what you, at least from what you know, what you see, it just doesn't make sense right now.
No, right now, yeah.
Yeah, that's hard. So I guess that's why you stayed away from, but there's corollary businesses that could support efficiencies, reduce costs in terms of property development, right? You don't care about that at all?
No, I do. I do visit, for example, I do look at what is the latest construction methodology.
Yeah, okay.
You know? And I said, oh, wow, you can do that?
Mm.
Never thought of it.
You know?
Mm-hmm. I said, that's a bloody good idea.
I think that makes more sense.
Yes.
I think that's the sense where you could re-engineer, rethink things from a first principles perspective because things have changed from decades ago.
Yes.
So we're just building on extrapolations of what we think is fundamental knowledge, but in reality, the underlying variables changed.
Correct. Correct.
Right. So,
So those do change.
Yeah. So you have to probably keep re-examining your biases to see that, right? And then it just turns up in performance, I guess. Right?
Yes, yes. That's the reason why I still visit all the construction fairs, whatever, just for a walk.
See what's up.
It's just for a walk.
Yeah. Why isn't property tech not bigger today? And especially, I don't know if you know about Southeast Asia, but at least Malaysia, we know that. You know, if you look at the U.S., you have your Zillow, your Trulios, your Redfins. At least that's on the software layer.
Yep.
I think we famously know a lot of construction, well-funded startups failed. That was probably a notoriously harder problem to solve with tech, right?
Yep.
What is your take on why it's not bigger in Malaysia or Southeast Asia broadly?
I think we are lagging.
Okay. What would be the bottleneck then of that lag?
I think people. People's acceptance. Okay.
In what aspect of acceptance?
I think we haven't got past that threshold.
Mm.
You know, the early adopters are still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the early adopters. But you still have to go past that threshold.
Yeah.
Before the whole masses come in.
Mm-hmm.
So until and unless that happens, I don't think people, it's not sexy enough.
Mm. But there always has to be some pioneer that does that, and then people get on the bandwagon.
Yes, yes. I mean, we all know that. I mean, the law of distribution.
Yeah. Right?
And not enough emphasis, and our market is too small to even push the needle.
Well, it's only small in respects of that from a purchasing power standpoint, right? If we had the same productivity as Singapore, it might be a different story, right? Could be big enough in certain respects, you think, or no? Or still too small?
We have quite spread out. That's okay. The thing.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Not dense enough.
Mm.
I mean, you look at Singapore and Hong Kong, they're very dense.
Yeah.
Things happen.
Forcing function.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You look at New York.
I
spend a lot of time in New York.
Yeah.
I look at things, my God, you know, how I wish I could be like this.
You could build it here.
Yeah. But down here.
But it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense. We've got so much land and people just tend to be a bit more extravagant.
Yeah.
I started to build in KL City near the race course those days, Petronas building down.
Okay.
When we first launched, we were starting at $400 a square foot.
Wow.
Yeah. People are saying, whoa.
You know? They were saying, wow.
Yeah.
I was saying, whoa, so cheap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
I mean, I walked through that path at 400 plus. And I still remember very clearly I had fights with property valuers.
Yeah.
I says, push it to 650.
Mm.
I mean, that's where we make money, right?
Yeah.
They said, you must be nuts. You know, you can never do it. And it wasn't that long ago. It was my lifetime.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, you can't sell, you know, there's no way. I understand. Today, you look at the numbers, crazy, right?
Yes. But even still, like, so say you have market value. What is the market value downtown, KL, on average?
Average? Probably about, okay, rule of thumb, $1,000 a square foot.
$1,000 a square foot. But we see developers pushing $4,000 a square foot for certain projects, right?
Yeah.
Are they crazy or are they onto something?
No. I think that is what you see, I always believe when you say that you're going for $4,000 a square foot, what is the product like?
Yeah.
$1,000, what is the product like?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can get a glass of cheap wine for $50 or a glass of Petrus. It's probably $5,000.
True.
Yeah. So it really depends.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you look at the population in KL, the general masses, let's say it's in the median range, they could only afford about maybe 2,000 square foot.
Yeah.
That's today's market price, you know?
Yeah.
If you're going right in the KLCC area.
Yeah.
Now, if you go around the peripheral, I mean, come on, PJ is going at 600.
Yeah.
Those days, 600, you know, in KL, you can't sell. Now it's 600 in PJ.
Yeah. PJ is pushing 1,000 plus too, right?
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, depends on your time frame. Say if your investment thesis, you believe KL is going to be a modern, developed nation.
Mm.
Like it's going to be just as modern as Singapore. Mm-hmm. And if you could sell to foreigners that thesis, actually buying now would be cheap then.
It is. It is. Right? Property market in KL now is climbing, okay, in this moment of time. So a lot of foreigners have come in.
Yeah.
And they don't blink.
Well, because relative to them, it's cheap for their market.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
They don't even blink. It's a funny thing, you know. Property is something that you feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
This is what you want.
Yeah.
It's cheap. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? If for investment and you think that you want to flip it, double the price in 3 years, I think you can't get it.
Yeah. Risky if you kind of play this game.
Yes.
You hit the wrong cycle, then that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, thanks for those insights. I want to talk a little bit about your past work.
Okay.
So maybe, because I have one specific topic I have in mind, but before we do that, I want to get the context, because in my research, I couldn't get all the details. So maybe you could help clarify some points.
Okay.
Right? So you graduated from Trinity College in Dublin in 1985.
Yep.
And then your first job that you got was in Pan Global Business.
Yep.
Right. But before that, you know, from 1985 to 1987, did anything notable happen?
Well, I mean, in terms of work?
Yeah, work.
Well, I came back and worked for my father.
Okay. Okay, so back then your father already had his family business in property development.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then why did you choose to leave then?
Well, actually, it's quite a funny thing. I didn't leave. we acquired that company.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, the family acquired the company.
Okay.
As usual, what can go wrong will go wrong.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a straightforward acquisition. Just buy, find a buyer, sell.
Okay.
But
are we talking about Penn Global?
Yeah.
So okay, yeah. so your father's business bought Penn Global.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's when you first started your career, like
on paper. Well, yes. Yeah. So off paper, I was already working the business.
Yeah. Okay.
So what I'm doing is that I had to go in and clean house.
Ah, wow.
That was my first exposure as a young kid.
Yeah, and and you're starting at the very bottom in a sense, I guess you could say. You're brand new into this, at least.
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Well, I started at the bottom in the family company.
Yeah.
I was working in this work site.
Yeah.
As a clerk of works, learning the ropes.
Mm. Traditional way.
Very traditional, okay? Yeah. And spent a couple of years, learn how to handle people, learn how to do calculations, everything under the sun.
Basically your MBA almost.
yeah. From the Institute of Hard Knocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you realize, what is this piece of paper that I learned from UK? Yeah. You know, it's a waste of time, you know? So then when we acquired that company, during that time, something went wrong, as in terms of shareholders' disgruntlement.
Mm.
And we had to turn the company around in terms of making the right profit before we could flip.
Yeah.
It's a straightforward. The idea is very straightforward. Buy at this level.
Yeah.
Revamp.
Yeah.
Clean house.
Yeah.
Sell at a higher value. I mean, that's as basic as it can go.
It's the traditional private equity model.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So that's what we did. And before that, we were doing with a few other companies.
Okay.
No problem. No hitch straight away.
Yeah.
This one got stuck. So somebody has got to put on the hat and go and do some real work.
Yeah. Always someone got to do it.
Yeah. So I think that whole bunch of us went in, clean house, and because we have got so many subsidiaries of all different walks in life, and that was fun.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
So it almost sounds very private equity. So what was the family core business then?
All along, property development.
All along property development. So where did your dad get the notion to want to flip company? It seems very different at the time. Is this different at the time or is this
very
normal?
No. Very different. Also by, I guess, coincidence. Going back to his time, okay? My grandfather, his father, from China, didn't have a lot of education.
Yeah.
Institute of Hard Knocks, learning to do anything under the sun.
Yeah.
He was a truck driver for the Japanese occupation during the Japanese.
When they were here, yeah.
Yeah. And he was ferrying goods from one area called Balik Pulau all the way down to town. Mm. Basically, just ferrying transportation.
Yeah, logistics.
Yes.
Logistics.
Yeah. Not the way we know, but anyway. Yeah. And if we have time, I'll tell you the funny stories. That's how he started.
Yeah.
And during Japanese time, he made lots of money.
Hmm, interesting.
Unfortunately, he's also a great gambler.
Mm, very common problem back then too.
Yes. I guess that's the...
You hear the story a lot.
Yeah. So that's how it started. And he used to ferry people around, workers, for after the Japanese War, for the British government to repair drains, you know, broken down buildings, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Subcontracting work.
Mm.
Okay. There are, of course...
Okay.
That's where it began. Yeah. And my grandfather was illiterate in terms of English.
Mm.
And taking work from the local government is British, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a chicken and duck.
So
anyway, my dad was studying in St. George's High School in Penang, English school. And he saw a lot of, favoritism.
Mm.
And the British tend to yell and shout, and those who don't speak the language.
Yeah.
And my grandfather is one of them.
Mm.
And my father decided that he has to come out and be the intermediary between the DO or whoever, you know, to help my grandfather.
Mm.
So my grandfather just said to him, I think he was in Form 5, and he said, why didn't you come out? So he did.
Mm.
He came out, and my grandfather took him to the what we call very senior clerk, technical assistant, don't know what.
Yeah,
in those days,
yeah.
And ask him, could you teach my son how to read prints, maps,
wow,
drawings, and calculate, I guess, quantities.
Mm.
That's where he started. And he did that, he liked it, and then he could speak the lingo.
Yeah.
And the district officer, which is the British, loved him.
Mm.
So anything below, I think, a couple of $100 or whatever, it is, don't have to go to tender. Typical government thing, right?
Yeah.
So they just get Mark Kok to do it.
Mm.
You know?
Okay.
That's where he first started. And he told me that his first year doing that, he had so much money in his bank that he couldn't believe it. So I said, how much is so much? You know?
Yeah.
Oh, 24,000.
Wow. Must have been a lot back then.
I guess so.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And those days, he says that, you know, he was talking to mom, my mom, if I have 200,000, you know, I'll retire. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
In those days.
What is enough?
So that was the beginning of the not enough.
Yeah. Still young and ambitious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how we started.
Okay.
And we won a lot of road repair works, building drains, building bridges. So you escalate as you get along.
Yeah.
We repaired a lot of old bungalow, government bungalow houses.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, you can do it. And I want it this way, and he could understand it, interpret. Mm-hmm. And he did that.
That's so fascinating that your moat and your advantage back in the day would be language.
Yes.
That's what makes your company defensible in a sense.
Or at least advantageous
to getting the bids, right?
Yeah. So that was the fun part.
Interesting. So did your father ever think about this in terms of private equity, or what was his thinking? He's just thinking quick money, or?
Quick money.
Okay.
Because in those days, it's like survival.
Yeah.
To make sure that this year's Chinese New Year is better than last year's.
Yeah. And this is before the currency crisis, right? So
way before.
So then why this mentality, quick money? Was it just the nature of the market at the time, or?
Survival.
Okay.
All Asian that came out from China here.
Yeah.
It's
okay, so it's just the mentality.
Mentality.
Yeah. But he had a core business in property development, you would say that by then?
Starting from that, and then he started working up.
I see. So still in flux then.
Yes.
But he still had enough capital to actually buy and sell businesses.
Well, it was like sweating his
okay, yeah. So
you know?
That's where the hunger is, I guess.
Yes.
And then the existential of, you know, if this doesn't go through, then we have no more money.
Yeah. We're going to eat porridge tonight.
But you spent a good 6 years there. And so does that mean you were successful? You were able to turn things around and sell it?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
We did.
Okay.
Well, we did, of course, made a bundle.
Yeah.
Yeah. But bearing in mind that we have to be very careful. You know, we stayed below the radar all the time.
Yeah.
We don't want to be...
Yeah, if you get flagged and then, of course, someone's going to come...
It
always seems to be the case, especially back in those times, I'm sure.
Like
regulations were different, laws were different, I'm sure.
That's right.
So then after this really good... That must have been a really fantastic experience. Then you became CEO of... How do you say this? MassB?
Yes. That is actually my family company.
Oh, so that's your family company.
Yeah.
Okay. And so when I was doing research on MassB, I couldn't find anything except for a bunch of potentially subsidiaries. I saw MassB Biotech, MassB Eco... So this is all actually the same company? Or?
Yes. Okay. Yes. All different subsidiaries, rather.
Okay.
We tend to do a lot of things.
Okay.
So like I said, in those days, it was pre-internet days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we can be very shy about it. We
Okay. So that's that was the flipping businesses, because they still exist in the registry, yes. all these companies. Yeah. And I actually see on LinkedIn, some people actually still have worked for some of these companies. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. So that was probably from that time period of flipping. And then, so you became CEO, and then this is where you really start to become an expert in property development then.
Yeah. Actually, I became an expert in turning businesses around.
Okay.
You know, I look at business because we have so many types.
Yeah.
You know, we have got insurance, we've got textile, we've got manufacturing, we've got development, we've got financials.
Does that explain the gap from 1993 to 1997? You were still flipping businesses or?
93 to 97. I think I had a quarrel with my dad. I left.
Interesting. Oh, you left.
I left.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Also quite a common story too, right?
Yes, it is. We just don't see eye to eye.
On how to run the business.
Yes.
Okay. So then how did that get resolved? Because eventually you came back and you did become CEO. So.
Well, it was an unfortunate circumstances because my mother had breast cancer.
Oh. Okay.
So I had to come back. Yeah. The good thing is that I came back and her cancer went into remission. Mm-hmm. So I just had to be a filial son.
It's choosing what you prioritize in life. And yes. You chose family.
Yes.
Which is fine.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, not to say anything, you know, I chose to come back.
Okay. Okay.
You know, I couldn't stay away.
And then you had this stint officially, at least on paper, from 1993 to 1997, where you were CEO. Now, this is very interesting, the next jump, because this is your family business. You kind of left, you come back, you flipped, you've gone through hell, high hell and heaven, and done everything for this company. And you are running it now, right? And then, however, your next thing that you list on your career development is you became COO of a different company.
Yes, yes.
So
it's just, like I said, you wanted a change of environment.
Despite being on top?
I guess working on your own, you're working in a shell. I mean, in a little eggshell thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just want to explore.
Yeah,
and realize whether you are worth anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So like I said, it's sometimes just to go out and
see what's out in the world.
Test the market.
Yeah.
Am I that bad?
Yeah. You know, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you think about? How do you become CEO after being CEO, right? It's a different mindset shift. There's also different types of roles of COO, right?
Yes.
So
I learned a lot from that.
Yeah.
Okay. The simple way of classifying what a CEO and a COO is, a CEO is a outside and COO is Mr. Inside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So being the COO, I run everything within the company.
Yeah.
The CEO just go and make money in deciding the strategy.
Yeah.
Then you tell me, if you want to go that way, I got to plan all the way. Mm. So I'm the general and you're the prime minister.
Mm, I see.
Or the king, mm-hmm. or the emperor, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's the most common framework. But there are other frameworks, right, where, for example, succession planning, COO is made to become CEO. There's the mentor who just does it for a few years but then retires because he was just helping the CEO transition to a more mature phase.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
so.
Yes.
Do you see this in your mentoring group? Do you see these different roles and people understanding frameworks, or is it more of what you described, that how they keep things?
Well, you're right. Absolutely right. I have, in fact, I have been approached to ask to be a CEO of another group for 2 years to help the new CEO coming up.
Mm.
So I said, what role do I play? He says, oh, you're the acting CEO. Yeah, I said, you don't have to call.
They won't accept that though, right?
Yeah. I said, okay, forget the name.
Yeah.
Tell me what.
Correct.
Yeah. Tell me what the roles are.
Yeah.
So they wanted me to do that.
Yeah.
I felt that maybe I'm a little bit too lazy to do it now.
Well, your priorities are different.
Correct.
Yeah.
The priorities are different. It was exciting. I mean, I was quite chuff when people ask me because feeling that, oh God, I'm 62 years old, people still want me.
Hey, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. But like I said, then I realized that a lot, we have a severe lack of talent.
Yeah, I would agree, because if you look at all the property developers, or at least the big ones, they cycle through CEOs very fast. Yes. And it's almost like, I don't know if this is true. This is not my domain, so take what I say in stride. Mm-hmm. It seems like people are failing forward, right? And that there's not enough competence. And I mean, of course, there's a dynamic where it's a family clan business.
Yes.
And it's very hard to deal with the ultimate chairman or the actual decision maker, right? So professional, but you know, in the interest of professionalizing, you would think people would try to make that a smoother transition, but it doesn't seem to work.
Doesn't work, yeah. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, in this region's context, the founders, the owners have absolute say.
And they're still very active, even though they're retirement age.
They are playing golf.
Yeah.
So do you want to go into that kind of game? They are so different from the
different
US.
You're optimizing different things at the
point. Yes, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
You look at it, it's going to take probably another 30 years before we reach the level of what the US are doing.
Mm. Where it's fully professionalized.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, the owners and they are so separate.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, I mean, it causes a different problem, but you would think if you were the owner, that's the kind of life you would live, where you don't have the stress, but you get all the upside, right? At least you would think so.
But they have the mentality, the mindset saying that, okay, if you don't do it yourself, nobody will do it for you because it's your money.
Yeah.
They can't let that go.
Yeah.
They can't let that go. So they haven't achieved the status of, like you said, let people make the money for you.
Yeah. Do you see that in your group? Do you talk about that? Do you bring it up? Is it something you consider, or?
I brought it up as a subject.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's
not receptive. People are not receptive.
No, it's lukewarm.
Mm, interesting.
Okay. Yeah. There are some. There's one that is trying to do it.
Yeah.
But let's see. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
We'll see. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do know a few families that are, at least they've made a constitution within the family.
Yes.
Okay. And a succession plan. And ultimately, it's up to then the next generation how to professionalize it. But at least there's more structures that I'm seeing. Some are still very loose, though. It's just more like how I feel, or like it's all in my head, and they think everyone could read their mind, and you know. So, but that's we're still very far, like you said. Yeah. I think
very far.
Yeah. So then this leads to the last point on your, at least on paper, you are now the CEO and president of Macaque International Group. So how is that related to MassB, your family group?
Okay. When my father passed away, things get reshuffled around.
Mm. Okay. Because it's usually there's a lot of people involved on the cap table, right?
Yeah. So what I did was that we reshuffled it.
Okay.
And actually, Macaque International is named after my father.
Yeah.
So my father tried to professionalize the thing. Mm. It didn't work because he couldn't let go.
That's probably the most common reason why it can't work.
You
just can't let go.
Yeah. I mean, he announced to everybody that he's retiring at 60.
Yeah.
He never retired until he passed away, which is 77.
Still worked to the last day.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I love him. I love him to bits because he gave me a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I miss him.
Yeah.
Because he's my sounding board.
Of course.
Yeah, that is the important part. Then I realize when I take the next step, you know, to go to Vistage.
Yeah,
that's how I see this relationship, and I know there's a big gap.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's why I'm here,
mm-hmm.
and I feel that you know I should do help people to make a little bit changes here.
Yeah.
Hopefully, it makes a huge ripple on the other end.
Mm-hmm. I see.
That's my part. Okay. My little part.
Okay, so then you spun off and then you are now in charge of, this is the new family business, I guess you can say. Mm. And I guess it kind of splintered to some degree.
Yep.
And you've been doing it for quite some time, right? It was many years, like 14 years, I think, from 2009?
Well, reason being is that because there was the overlap in transition.
Yeah.
Yeah. This company was started during my father when he was around.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. So that's when I told him, this is what I want to happen.
Mm. So that you have more control over your destiny and you can exert yourself.
Yeah, correct.
And that's his. Yes. It's very hard to live in the shadow, I'm sure,
of
the founder. Right?
Yeah. I want to eat this. He wants to eat that. So you got to eat that.
Yeah.
That kind.
Okay. But it seems like he was supportive at least.
He was, yeah.
Okay.
He was.
And so then you must have done many developments under Macaq International Group.
I have, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nothing to shout about. I mean, everybody does the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the only iconic building that I have now would be finishing the 50-story building in town.
The Isola at KLCC.
Yeah.
Okay. That's been that's an interesting business case, I think, right? Because, and I maybe you could help clear the history of that too, because it seems it's deeply rooted in your family's history and that at least the piece of land that's being developed, right, is under Maspi. Interestingly enough, Maspi Coffee. So you guys, I guess, had coffee ambitions at one point, or was it a flipped company?
It was, no. We actually bought a piece of land in China in coffee business.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But when my father passed away, I just couldn't hack it, the fact that, you know, I have to go fly in and out.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard, especially if you have a new family. And
Yeah. So, you know, I wound down a lot of things, what my father did.
I see.
My father is a very energetic man, okay?
Very ambitious, I could see.
Yeah. I mean, I will call him and says, where are you? Oh, I'm in Shanghai.
Huh? You don't know. I can't even tell you.
So that is that kind of man that I was dealing with.
Okay.
Like I said, I had to unwind a lot of things. We had a fertilizer business in Malacca.
Yeah.
I had to unwind because I couldn't bring myself to go down to Malacca to, you know, every week.
Yeah.
It's a 1.5 hours one way, you know?
Yeah.
So if you can't control it, can't see it, can't touch it within an earshot, I wouldn't do it.
But why not consider professionalization?
I need people.
More risk, I guess?
Yeah. More risk.
But these businesses were profitable already, or?
Small profit.
So in order to, the amount of focus to scale one would probably be enormous. And okay.
You know?
It's not worth the headache, I guess.
It's not. Yeah. I would rather, you see, I think that it was such a small business. It was doing like, I don't know, $200,000-$300,000 a year a profit. I might as well wind down the business, keep the land. I'll probably make more money from the land.
Which is probably true.
I don't have to employ 40 people.
Correct.
Madness, you know?
And also the headache to make that work. Yeah. That's true. Mm-hmm. So then, how did this, so let's talk about Isola as a business case. How did this deal come about? Because you're the landholder. So I know that historically it's rooted in OCR land, right? Ong Chong Realty, I think.
Yeah.
Right. And then I suspect one of the kids did a buyout of Takaso?
Talasco.
Talasco.
Yeah. They did.
Yeah.
That is a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't know them.
Okay.
They came via some introduction.
I see.
They needed a project to run in KL.
Yeah.
They have been a developer for a couple of places.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we met. We had to sit down and have a chat.
Yeah.
So at that time, I was concentrating in Johor.
For development.
Development.
Yeah.
So I said that this is too small for me to come back.
Interesting.
Yeah. Strange. Yeah. Huh? So I said, okay, find a company that can do this for me. And they were not the first company. I think they were the third or fourth company.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So I chatted with a few and they said this fit the bill. Okay.
In terms of all what you required.
What I required, yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. Then they carried on. Well, we are delayed because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
That is, nobody could predict that.
Yeah, that was a huge delay.
Yeah.
Which means ultimately, how did you think about dealing, structuring the deal, right? Because then that speaks to the risk or the capital during the pandemic who took the hit, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting case, right? Because you have the land bank and you're looking, it's too small for your purview.
Mm.
So then how do you find the right partner? How do you think about finding the right partner? How do you put a deal together like that together?
Well, I first of all, I wanted somebody to have the means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well capitalized.
Yeah. So well capitalized to come in. He came in and I said to him, okay, I'll give you the land. Then a lot of people will say to me, we'll build this way, we do this way, we'll do this, and then this is how we pay you.
Yeah.
What I wanted was an iconic development.
Okay.
That is the first thing. They came back, designed the thing. I got them the plot ratio that they require.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, fine. And then they asked me, can we charge your land? I says, that can be done.
What does that mean?
Borrow money on.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So I says, that can be done.
So using the land as the collateral.
Collateral.
Yeah.
I says, fine. To help them to, because that's their first.
First, first cash flow.
Yeah.
Oh, so first.
Their first project.
Okay.
So I said, fine.
Yeah.
So let's have an agreement.
Yeah.
If you cock up, I'll be the first person to walk in because I have the expertise.
Yeah, correct. You know how to do it.
Yeah, I know how to do it. So that's not a problem. So we structured that deal. He agreed. Mm. Okay. I says, I give some, you give some.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we split the profit.
Okay. Okay. When you say give some, give some, I mean, you already put up the land. It's a quite sizable chunk. You giving up cash too, or are they giving up all the cash?
They have to borrow from the bank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they take the risk.
They take the risk of the loan. I take the risk allowing the land to be pledged.
True. True. Yeah. Because you could lose the land.
Yeah, I could lose the land. But I want a personal guarantee from him.
Oof. Well, that's quite common too, I think, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So he has the means. So that's fine. So I think that the project is too, I mean, it's a bit too small for him to run away.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
So then I says, okay, let's split the profit. So the standard splitting is like 70-30. Mm. So I said, since I allow all this, I want more.
Mm.
So he agreed.
Mm.
So fine.
Was that a tough negotiation?
No.
No?
No.
Is it because you had more leverage?
Because we both know each other, know exactly what's going on.
Mm, okay.
You know, there's no need to beat around.
Everything's on the table.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, nothing to hide.
Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I said, okay.
And then, so now the project should be coming to completion.
By next year?
By next year. Okay. Yeah.
So we delayed by 1 year, 2 months, something like that.
That's quite, I remember I saw an article saying 2017, 40% was sold. So there's some buyers waiting for a long time then? Or?
Yep. Yep.
Okay, wow.
Yep. I mean, this, like I said, we can't help it.
Yeah, it's the nature
of it. And this extension is given by the government. So it's not that we are going to pay a penalty on it.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We were hit by a few snags here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so of course, some performance of contractors and everything. But that's not my problem. It's his problem.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with it.
Okay. Hopefully the project goes successfully then.
Yeah, and
then,
I hope so too.
Yeah. And that'd be another addition to the KL skyline, right?
Yeah.
In downtown KL.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about the future. Mm. So I came across a very interesting question on a public forum. And the question was, what do you think Malaysia looks like in the next 10 years, like politically, economically, socially, business-wise? And you know, there seems to be a split camp, you know, optimist versus pessimist. So where do you land in this?
Well, I think I look at it as probably an optimist because I think that the current government will stamp out a lot of bad practices.
Mm.
Yeah. And
interesting.
I hope that the non-Bumis, the non-Malays, will have a larger say.
Mm.
And that stemmed out. Actually, I'm not the one that said it. I can't remember who, but quite some time ago, as long as there's a lot of wealth in the company and those in control can't split it out, divide it equally, there will be a lot of disgruntled stakeholders.
Yeah.
That's what's happened.
Yeah.
So as long as that is not resolved, right, they will recognize that eventually to safeguard themselves, eventually they have got to spread the wealth out to everybody.
Okay. Well, interesting what that would look like, though.
Yeah.
It's very hard to imagine, right?
Yes.
Because of at least where we're standing. But if that logic holds true, it's very optimistic.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's the way I would see it.
Yeah.
We are very fortunate. I don't have a lot of stake here now.
Mm. So you diversified.
Yeah. So because during the previous administration, a couple of administrations, all of us will prepare to throw in the towel and walk.
Mm, interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, I can't walk because my land is here. I can't take the land away.
That's a bit harder.
Yeah. Yeah. But whatever you have, you put it everywhere else.
Yeah, spread it around.
Yeah, spread it around.
In terms of diversifying to preserve wealth, then Have you kept it in the region or you or even further abroad?
Further abroad.
Further abroad. Yeah. More stable.
I don't know whether it's stable or not.
Yeah.
Because right now, I mean, I do worry about what's happening in the US. I look at UK. I mean, they're hitting recession now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing what you see there.
Yeah.
Actually, at the end of the day,
yeah,
it's better at home.
Yeah.
You know?
Interestingly enough.
So, I don't know.
It's hard to say where we're going to land, but I think your advice maybe diversification quite important.
Very important.
And not necessarily just by, of course, revenue streams, by country, geography.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, because we really don't know how this is shaping up, right? So,
we do not know how it pan out. No.
Yeah. So for the last section, you know, I would love to learn more about you as a person. What would you say your greatest superpower is personally or professionally?
Easy to talk to.
I think that's true.
Easy to talk to.
Yeah.
People find it easy to throw everything out, right? To be vulnerable. I'm very receptive.
Yeah.
A lot of my peers actually said to me that, you know, I don't know whether you say it right, but, you know, it could be, for all I know, all bullshit. But I'm convinced. You know?
Where do you think that comes from, this natural ability to get people to talk to you, or you're very easy to talk to?
Listen, calm, don't get jitters, you know, don't react instantly. I will assess the situation very well first before I open my mouth.
That must be more genetic, you'd think, right? Innate in who you are as a person.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for me, that's a lot harder to... I'm more reactive by nature, you know. can be more explosive depending on the situation.
No, right? I think it's age also, I think.
Maybe. That's true. Like, I am... I like to think I'm more calm than I was when I was in my teens. Some people might disagree, but, you know.
Yeah.
I think I'm moving along in that direction too. So I think you're right. Age is definitely a big factor that... It seems very intuitive, but a lot of times gets discounted, I think.
Yes.
Right? Especially when you're talking about in the context of coaching and this kind of thing.
Right.
Because, you know, young people can add value. We do forget that. It's like, you know, your son, you talk to him like an adult. Mm. So we tend to forget both sides, I guess. You know, it's a balance between that. So say once you've cultivated those, you know, like say you know that's like your superpower. How do you go about defining those skill sets and marketing it?
I'm very lucky that I don't have to go out and market it. Okay. But what I want to do is to change the climate a little bit at a time. Okay, that's where I want to go into the market and start coaching and talking to people.
Yeah,
I'm not the person that would like to stand on the stage and do a lot of
grandstanding.
Yeah, you know, I don't.
Yeah,
you know, but if you want to talk about things, something serious, I'm willing. I'm here.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my phone gets messages every day. You know. My wife would say to me, "Switch it off." I says, "I said I can't. Excuse me. It's now 12 o'clock. I got to go out and take a call."
Yeah. Well, I mean, you enjoy it, right?
Yes.
It's not work. I think what I learned, at least in my university, was it's a Jesuit university in New York.
Okay.
What they taught as one of the core foundations in the courses is, you know, serving other people, and then typically that's the best way to serve yourself, which I find to be very true.
It is.
You know, as I iterated my life and my career, I find that more and more, you derive more pleasure out of it. You know?
True.
Yeah. And then have you ever explicitly mapped out your core values? You think about this a lot, or have you done this exercise?
Nope.
So off the top of your head, do you say, what would you think your top core values would be? Just guessing.
Family.
Family? Anything else, second or third?
I value friendship.
Friendship. Deep friendship?
Deep friendship.
Meaningful friendship.
Meaningful friendship.
Yeah.
People that I could, you know, I don't have to see you every day.
Yeah.
5 years from now, I call up and says, what the bleep have you been, you know?
Yeah.
And I sit down and just catch up both times.
Yeah, just like nothing changed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are quite hard. And surprisingly, a lot of those friendships can be fragile too, where you think you have that, but then they kind of disappear.
Yeah.
So I think it's more meaningful as you get older. Mm. Do you have anything else you would like to talk about, or you want to shout out anything? You have anything you're selling, anything you want to shill, your coaching business or deals?
I think that, you know, like I said, I'm always here.
Mm.
If you want a friend, call. call me. Mm. That's about it.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect advice. And so thank you for your time. And, you know, I learned a lot and it was great having you.
Thank you. Thank you. For that. I learned a lot too from you.
All right. Thank you
very much.
Okay. Yeah, bye.